are listening to Benjamin Walker's Theory of Everything.
At Radiotopia, we now have a select group of amazing supporters that help us make all our shows possible. If you would like to have your company or product sponsor this podcast, then get in touch. Drop a line to sponsor@radiotopia.fm. Thanks.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You are listening to Benjamin Walker's Theory of Everything. The following installment is called Red, White, Blue, and Orange.
All right, so, I mean, the first thing that strikes me is that this is utterly cartoonish.
I own you, Amor. You belong to me.
I own you? I mean, how is that going to elicit...
Look at me.
...good... strong, actionable intelligence. It's absurd.
If you don't look at me when I talk to you, I hurt you. You step off this mat, I hurt you. If you lie to me, I'm gonna hurt you. Now, look at me. Look at me, Amar!
I'm watching the torture scenes from Zero Dark 30, the Hollywood movie about the hunt for Osama bin Laden, with this guy, Joshua Phillips.
I'm the author of the book None of Us Were Like This Before, American Soldiers and Torture.
Joshua Phillips spent years interviewing interrogators and soldiers. He knows all about what happened to the detainees who were tortured and what happened to the Americans who did the torturing. I went to his apartment and we recorded a torture commentary track for our imaginary Criterion edition of the film.
So the Latin music is not only there to disorient, but in many cases in all three war theaters, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Guantanamo, it was used really for the purpose of sleep deprivation. So in this scene, this is the prep for the waterboarding.
When you lie to me, I hurt you.
So everything is framed in those terms. You lie to me, I hurt you. I mean, again, made for TV stuff, man. At this point, Maya is just an observer.
Grab the bucket.
Maya's the film's protagonist, the female CIA agent who's relentless in her search for Osama bin Laden.
Put some water in it.
And while she's not doing any torturing in this scene, she's definitely paying attention to what Dan, the guy doing the torturing, is doing. She's definitely soaking it all up for later.
Dan is such a tough guy and a cool guy that we kind of sympathize with, you know, his approach. You think that it's effective? Seems rational.
Where was the last time you saw bin Laden? Where was the last time you saw bin Laden, huh?
Seems like, you know, we're dealing with implacable terrorists and this is the only way of extracting information from them.
This is what defeat looks like, bro. Your jihad is over.
Right, okay. There's so many things that are so messed up about that scene. Okay, so first of all, we saw Dan waterboard Amar, you know, strangle him with water. Once, twice, three times maybe? How many times was KSM, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and Abu Zubaydah? How many times were those guys waterboarded? 183 times or something absurd like that?
In the end, everybody breaks, bro. That's biology.
Okay, so that's really twisted, absurd, deeply troubling logic, but certainly ubiquitous in terms of the overall perceptions of how people regard torture interrogation. You know, this line really captures the essence. It's biology. Everybody breaks. And I would hear this sort of reasoning echoed throughout all of our war theaters. That sort of reasoning is echoed everywhere. I mean, there's expectation that it's a biological function that you can A, calibrate pain and duress, and B, under enough pain and duress. A detainee will crack, and in cracking, they will provide actionable intelligence. So there's so many problems with each one of those strands of thought. I mean, my God, even the CIA's own researchers found in the course of doing research on interrogation and torture that the part of the problem with using torture for interrogation is its deleterious effects on memory and recall.
Get him up.
So, I mean, the thing is that it's biology, bro, that exactly the opposite happens.
This is a dog collar.
No! Come on. No! Okay, so he's naked, wearing a dog collar. And this, what is this supposed to do for us? I mean, really, I mean, the thing that strikes me about all these techniques that they're doing here, the sexual stuff, the, you know, the walling, the dog collar, you know, it's amateur hour.
I got you. Huh? This box here, this box sucks. But I'm going to put you in it.
All right, I'm turning this off. I'm not watching another second of this. So, Joshua, you've written that these scenes are fake, inaccurate, and cliched. But more importantly, you seem to believe that they are lethal to the very soul of America. So let's just cut to the chase and spell this out.
For me, what is troubling about it is you may not necessarily see torture producing the perfect results in each scene in which torture is used during an interrogation, but cumulatively, we see no torture, no bin Laden.
I doubt we'll ever learn the truth about how we really found Osama bin Laden. But there is one thing I know for certain, and that is we did not get any information from Umarov Mohibullah.
Raymond Umarov Mohibullah.
His name is Umarov Mohibullah.
Umarov?
Umarov? You.
Umarov?
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 Mohibullah.
Mohibullah.
H. Mohibullah.
And how old is he?
Chancellor.
24.
I met Mohibullah Umarov in the Obihingu Valley, which is in Tajikistan's Pamir Mountains. And he lived there with his family, including a younger brother who's missing a leg. The brother lost it when they were boys and during the civil war in Tajikistan when a bomb dropped on their grandparents' potato field. And Mohibullah himself suffers ailments from his time in prison.
And how did you end up in the valley?
Well, that's a longer story.
Mackenzie Funk has traveled the globe writing magazine articles about faraway places like Siberia and Greenland. In 2006, he wrote a story about his encounter with Umarov Mohibullah for Mother Jones magazine. But the story begins with a mountaineering trip he took in 2003.
I had a long interest in Central Asia, and that's the former Soviet Union, all the different stans, as they're called. So Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, if I didn't say that one already. And even in college, I'd always wanted to visit them because they seemed so off the map. And eventually I did. The first time I went into this region, Bakio, was on a mountaineering trip. And part of the appeal of this, of the Pamir in Tajikistan in particular, is there's these beautiful mountains that no one ever has really explored in the last decade. It's just sort of, it was always off the map, but it dropped more off the map as soon as the Russians left. And how it happened that I went into that valley was on a mountaineering trip with my friend Lars. And people told us, don't go into that valley. That is where the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan walks back and forth when they're doing their attacks. And so it's dangerous for you to go there. But as we were doing this high mountain traverse, we ended up walking down this valley, which is the Surhab River in the Vahio region. And we go down there, and all these villagers were hailing us, saying, hello, hello. And all the signs of these militants that we'd been worried about, people said, avoid that valley, and they weren't there. And eventually we asked in broken Russian, my Russian isn't great, but it's good enough to talk to people a little bit, said, well, what about the militants. And they're like, oh, they haven't been here for 3 or 4 years. It was one of those things where I realized how lacking our intelligence is in this part of the world. I realized probably for the first time in my life that we don't know what's going on, and that America doesn't know what's going on in these parts of the world, and that any intelligence we have on where the militants are or aren't isn't any good. And they told us we were the first Westerners in about a dozen years to be there. And we walked from village to village down that valley.
So I just knew America according to the map, yeah. The old map. And then the second time I knew America when America was bombing Afghanistan.
Yes.
And so the next year I decided to come back. I wanted to do a big mountaineering, maybe a ski mountaineering traverse, and do a magazine article about that. And I got the help of a mountain guide who's for the purposes of this story, we'll call him Kubad. And he and I went up there and we began trekking, basically, to see if this pass would work out for a later ski expedition. And we stopped to visit, and we visited a farmer named Hyrat, who I'd met the summer before. And I'd known was a really good guy. And we're sitting around in his house one night. He's got this little whitewashed, tiny house. He himself is missing some fingers from a mine back in the Civil War, Tajikistan. And he's sitting around feeding us potato soup, because that's all there ever is in that valley. And he says, you know, there's a kid in the valley who's been to America. And I said, well, I don't think that's true. No one here has really been out too much out of Tajikistan. He said, no, seriously. He's been to America. He's been to, he was in prison there. They made a big mistake. And I said, well, okay. And he said, yeah, he was in Cuba. And I said, Cuba? And he said, yeah, Cuba. I put it together. I knew that they'd been releasing the first prisoners from Guantanamo. And I was like, wow, this is one of them. And at the time, there really hadn't been any interviews with these people who had been released. There hadn't been any news from what's it like inside Guantanamo. It had all been sort of smoke and mirrors with the media trying to visit. So I was very excited to go track this guy down. So it took a couple days, but we got our jeep and went down the valley and met him.
So he went in October 2001, mm-hmm. Pakistan, and he was imprisoned in May 2002.
Ah, okay.
In 6 months, yeah.
So for those, what was he doing in those 6 months?
Chokari badam, shashmo.
Shashmo is kashat, porka, mekhegashat khondo, mekhegashat,
mekhegashat. Partly walking, partly studying. Mm. Yeah, actually he doesn't like Pakistan because of climate. Mm. Everything actually he says it's not as a good place, but he had to finish his school.
Yeah.
He had to have his diploma, and this is the most important thing, to have a diploma.
Was he a good student?
A good student. Nazmi khundi? Student Nazmi?
Hi.
Hi, Gaza. In Tajikistan, you know, boys, they don't like to study.
Yeah.
You know, I'd like to make a business. And one day, and 5-6 in the morning, the secret service of Pakistan came. So there was a library where they had a small office.
Office.
Small office, yeah. Uh-huh.
So it was in a little room in a library, or?
Мега, аму китобхона, дадуни китобхона, як дафтар буд, як офис буд ки, аму корои як ким тоҷикиш корхонаи майда буд.
Дуруст? Инамо, ин мисол нами хона, я, нами китобхона. Умадан хоб, ди хоб ве дор мукан.
So they came, we were sleeping that time. They woke us up.
Гуфтан мурод чмо бастан, стор бастан.
So they took their eyes, how to say.
They covered their eyes?
Yeah, they covered their eyes, and they... they took this, their t-shirt.
His own t-shirt.
Yeah. Yes, the T-shirt.
And made the eye thing out of the T-shirt?
My question mark. Oh.
And then the handcuff out of the T-shirt. And then what was he wearing on top?
What chip was he?
I was just a guy who had told that.
Ah, so that they had something.
This happened to be about 10 days after the first suicide bombing that Pakistan had ever had. There was a bus that had been blown up by a car bomber outside the Sheraton in Karachi. So this was Pakistan's first suicide bombing, which, you know, now they've had so many. And it was after that happened that there were ads in the paper saying, report any suspicious foreigners. Well, here are these two Tajik guys staying in a library. And so the best guess is that someone reported them. And the agents came at night, and then they were taken to prison.
So then he brought him to one room. He said beton in Russian. Concrete.
Concrete.
And in a concrete room, which was 50 centimeters wide and 1 meter long. And then he stayed there for 10 days with the...
They put him in a tiny cell. This is one of a number of times he was put in a cell that seems to have been the size of a refrigerator. And he was there for quite some time. He got taken to some Americans who interrogated him at what sounded sort of like a luggage factory. At least there were a lot of suitcases and briefcases around. That's how he described it.
So, the two Americans, what did they look like?
I saw Rambo.
I saw Rambo. And what is he was saying here? He had the cut off arms?
Yeah, yeah.
Please describe everything he just said.
It's the same as you've seen in the movie.
Yeah, so he had the cut off arms, but he did some things. And he had the headband.
In the bandagos? So he was not in uniform.
What questions did they ask?
Do saati ki venga mu prso purskara chi saulomi kara. So first again about your personal information.
But the boraemi ki, ami terrorist ra kuk samishnu si yagun sa ti
da. And then they said, do you know any terrorist?
Ti da shinavi da medun.
Have you seen them? Have you heard about them? He's been asked, do you know Al-Qaeda? Have you seen Osama bin Laden?
He said,
yes, I've heard, but
I've
seen him in TV.
Was he afraid?
I didn't, because I knew that... I didn't do anything bad.
He told me, I knew I was going to be freed because I'm not a thief. I didn't do anything. They'll realize it's a mistake. But pretty soon he was flown off to Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan. And if you think about it, it's the barriers to entry are pretty low in this kind of thing. There were stories of the CIA, in fact, paying Pakistanis to bring in militants at the time. And the barriers to exit are extremely high. I mean, we've got people he was sort of in limbo. Nobody knew why he was there, but nobody wanted to take the chance to release him.
One day, woman, investigator, had talking with them. So this woman also said, according to you, to the conversation we had, you are not guilty. Yeah. I don't know why they brought you here.
What he told me was that interrogator after interrogator, including this one at Bagram, said, I don't know why you're here. They said that to his face. And yet he kept on getting moved in the system. And eventually they were all rounded up one day and put in a plane and flown to Guantanamo.
video. So once having lunch, stand up. Everybody stand up.
They were just one day just eating lunch.
Yeah, and they put their gloves, and they put them gloves in their hands. Yeah, and then they fix them with the scotch. The gloves.
Tape them. Okay.
Yeah, tape them. Yeah. Also, the special eyeglasses, which not allow you to see anything. And then
face mask.
Yeah.
Those photos that we all saw from Guantanamo. With the men in orange prison suits, with the hoods and the chains, getting frog marched into camp. That's how they brought Umarok to Cuba.
But they couldn't breathe well with them. So good. Do you have any questions to say? Yes. Where I am? I said, you are in Cuba.
They said, you are in Cuba. Finally, you have an answer.
But what kind of sabab man
are they? And the second question was, why you brought me here? What was my crime? Yeah. And
what was their answer?
And I say, according to your speech, according to your information, you are not guilty.
They said, we don't know why you're here.
Yeah.
He was a very positive person. Going into this, obviously, he kept thinking, I'm going to be free. This is a mistake. He didn't seem to have any particular beef with America. He didn't know much about America until, as you said, the bombs began falling in Afghanistan. And so he kept thinking he was going to be freed. But after a time, he thought, maybe this isn't about me.
My impression was that the first 5 months I was thinking that they are really looking for terrorists who belong to terrorist groups. They want to fight against the terrorism, against this Al-Qaeda and something like that. But after that, I had a new impression that they're not against terrorism, but they're against Islam.
The other people with him in the cell?
Yeah.
Did he think to himself, with me they made a mistake, but with these guys they did not make a mistake?
Мега, аму одамо ки бо ту дачи будан, дамо хуна, дамо жира.
О, касош аги намеш нюхтам, бисол фигр мекам ги, ам хамаш, ами месак дена гора нюх.
О, those who I didn't know, I thought, oh, they are guilty.
Неки, бааде ки рафтим да Куба, бааде ше ме прсим,
But later in Cuba, when he met some other people, then he understood there were many of them like him. That was interesting. He met a man who was 100 years old.
What?
With the big beard. He couldn't even hear well.
100 years old? Where was he from?
Asgjobda Musafir. He was from Afghanistan. And another guy, he had a small child, a 10-month child.
In the prison?
So in 1 month, this guy was allowed to visit his child only once.
So his child was brought from Afghanistan or?
Yani, u marda ka bo am gulak shu varana, Afghanistan. This guy took his baby and went to visit a doctor, and then he was arrested.
He was arrested at the doctor. Amazing.
Even these people, investigators, say, not only you are not guilty, there are a lot of people who are not guilty.
One thing we did get news about in the States was suicides. Mm-hmm. That there were many suicides in Guantanamo. Did he ever see them or experience this?
Yes, some people hang themselves.
Hang themselves using their clothing.
So they used this.
Use their sheets.
Sheets, yeah.
How many times did he see this?
Chambur did in Khalil.
Toy made him. Punznak as Piscasaki to adorn my cashier.
So, for instance, 15, 20 people suicide themselves once.
Did he ever think about suicide?
We got to go die if he can have So, yes, I was also thinking about that, but according to the Islam, it's not good.
Did he lose all hope that he would ever be free?
Yeah, I'm Guantanamo. چیزم امیدم نداشتی که خلاص میشه نه
دیگه امیدی برمدن نیست
So in these 2 years I've been in Guantanamo no one was afraid so he didn't think about freedom.
We focus so much on is torture okay, did we torture these people, and was it worth it, and the reality is maybe there's this small class of hardened Al-Qaeda prisoners who are being tortured or were tortured, and who there is a legitimate debate there. But there's this other class of people like Umarov who were swept up in the war on terror, put in this prison for years, and maybe we didn't waterboard them, but they did lock them up for 2 years. They did bind their hands and cover their eyes and put them in sensory deprivation, you know, goggles, and fly them to Cuba and back. And that's the story that no one's really focused on, and I think that's maybe the more important story.
Was there a time that was worst of all?
Every day was the same. Each week he's been called to have this
interrogation.
So the questions were the same. The only investigators were different.
So the different investigator comes in and asks always, who are you? How are you here? Do you know Al Qaeda?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you know where Bin Laden is?
Yeah.
I had the understanding maybe an hour or two into our 8-hour conversation that I'm asking him exactly what interrogator after interrogator after interrogator has asked him. How did you get here? What are all the steps? He seemed to tire of them, and he became more agitated at the end. And I was very aware that I had just this one moment with him. I had to get back to the States. I was certain that the Defense Department would not want to do any fact-checking with me. So this was it. This is one of those stories that you can't fact-check too well, and you can only know if it's real or not by... one, your gut, and then whatever else you can pick up along the way. So I just wanted to make sure the story was airtight. When he had his final conversation with one of the interrogators at Guantanamo, they took him to this room, the same interrogation rooms they always took him to, but this time they took him without shackles. And then they sat him down in front of this middle-aged American man, maybe 50-year-old white man.
The war happened, a lot of people involved in wars, and sometimes people who are not guilty, they're also involved in this process.
This is what the man said?
Yeah.
He
did apologize and say, you know, we are not against Islam, against to this people who are thinking bad things, terrorists, mm-hmm. We burned two years of your life, and we want very much you to not contact with bad people. Uh-huh. And if someone would say that let's fight against America, then contact them, then be with them, just set up your life.
They took him like this.
They hugged him.
Yeah.
I asked him, of course, how did you feel? Did you come out mad? Did you come out a terrorist even if you didn't start out as one? And no. His answer over and over again was no. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, there are many stories within it in Islam of people being imprisoned unfairly.
So if you knew the history of Islam, then you get more quiet.
Yeah.
He looked to religion for some sort of solace.
Religion teaches us to be quiet, patient.
The first thing I did when I got back was I emailed Harper's Magazine and I emailed the New York Times Magazine and I said, I just found one of the first Guantanamo detainees to be released. He has an incredible story. Are you interested? And both of them, for their own reasons, said, sorry. And so I made myself a list, a Word document that I still have here. And have on the list the NY Times Magazine, The Atlantic, Vanity Fair, Esquire, Harper's, New Yorker, GQ, Rolling Stone, Washington Post Magazine, LA Times Magazine, Boston Globe Magazine. Those were all ones that I pitched, and I would put a little, I'd cross them out after they weren't interested. One of the reasons I think it was so hard for me to get this published was that it was an impossible story to confirm. Like, how can we confirm any of this? Why should we believe his word against that of, you know, everyone in the military and everyone in the political establishment? Like, why would we believe some guy who'd been in Guantanamo when he says, I wasn't a terrorist? It's like, every guy in prison is innocent, right? Finally, after crossing a half dozen other magazines off my list, I went to Mother Jones. It wasn't a story that a lot of people saw. Five years later, in 2011, when WikiLeaks released the Guantanamo files, I typed in Umarov's name. Also, Homaro, because they had his name wrong in the official files. It doesn't say much, and yet here in their documents is exactly what he told me. That he was arrested by Pakistani police and held in a Karachi jail for a month, then sent to Afghanistan. That he'd been arrested in a library, even that little detail. The date matched up, the fact that no one knows why he was there, as an EC, they call it in this document, enemy combatant. No one knows why he was determined to be one, even though it says that he was determined to be an enemy combatant before he was sent to Guantanamo, whatever that means. One detail I didn't find in the WikiLeaks documents, and this is shocking in and of itself, is that Umarov wasn't compensated in any way for his experience. He was just dumped back into Tajikistan with nothing. And he does now suffer from a host of physical problems. He said that his eyesight was damaged from looking through so many chain link fences, and he wasn't the only one who said that. Other prisoners have reported the same. He says he has breathing problems now. He says he has back problems. When we started doing the interview, he just returned from getting injections from a local doctor for the lungs, I think. But the United States didn't offer him anything, and this is something that really bothers me a lot. I think about it all the time, and I asked him about it, and he didn't seem angry about it. He just seemed more amazed. For him, it was almost like a sign that they thought he was still guilty, because otherwise they would offer him something. The one thing that seemed to make him angry, as far as I could tell, was his nickname.
Osama.
The villagers call him Osama.
They're joking, but when you are not guilty and you hear this, of course, it's not pleasant.
Writer Mackenzie Funk and I put this radio piece together 2 years ago. It was the same week U.S. forces killed Osama bin Laden. I remember feeling the urgency at that time, like there was a moment where we as Americans might just come to our senses and say, enough is enough. We got Osama, now we should close Guantanamo. But that moment has passed. Today, in May 2013, Guantanamo is still open. On Facebook, you can like Camp Gitmo and follow it on Twitter. But the men in the prison cells still have not been charged with a crime nor told why they are there. As I put this program together, 100 of these men are on a hunger strike. Over 30 of these men are being force-fed, and at least 5 of these men have been hospitalized. But what is perhaps most troubling is that the majority of Americans remain committed to Guantanamo and what it stands for. The majority of Americans still believe that Guantanamo should remain open. I've spent way too much time trying to understand how this is possible. Sure, there is a lot of bad information out there. Most Americans are unaware that we've imprisoned the majority of these men for over a decade without charging them, and that many of these men, like Umar of Mohibla, don't even know why they are there. Most Americans have no idea that most of these men, like Umar of Mohibla, were simply in the wrong place at the wrong time. But I don't think Guantanamo is still open because of American ignorance. At times, it seems that this all might be explained by petty politics. In 2007, Obama made it clear that he wanted to close Guantanamo. And there are congressional Republicans who get out of bed every morning determined to make sure that the president does not get to do a single thing he wants to do. But I don't think politics can explain it either. I do, however, believe the 100 men on hunger strike have figured it out. These guys with tubes shoved down their throats, they definitely know why Guantanamo remains open. And they know that it's never going to close.
You've been listening to Benjamin Walker's Theory of Everything. This installment is called Red, White, Blue, and Orange.
Hi, I'm Lindsey Graham, the host of Wondery's American History Tellers. In our latest series, we explore the emergence of a covert network of secret routes and safe houses known as the Underground Railroad, which worked to shepherd fugitive slaves to freedom in the decades before the Civil War. Listen to American History Tellers on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Radiotopia.